You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the Wisconsin Chair Company, or as music historians know it, Paramount Records, a record label responsible for producing a huge catalog of legendary blues and jazz recordings.
First, we're getting a preview of tonight's presidential debate, the first of three showcasing the candidates in the general election this November.
Lester Holt, NBC Nightly News host, will moderate tonight's debate held at Hofstra University on Long Island. The debate begins at 8 p.m. Central. You can hear NPR coverage of the debate tonight here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mike Wagner joins us now for a preview of that debate. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm thinking about some of the words that have been used to describe the debate tonight. High stakes, historic, hyped. Given all that, how big a deal do you think this debate will be?
Well, it's a big deal in the fact that, you know, tens of millions of people are going to watch it, and they'll get to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump together for 90 minutes without breaks, talking about a lot of important issues about the future of the country. That's important. We have fewer and fewer water cooler moments now in our kind of fragmented media landscape, and so this is something that lots and lots of people are going to watch. It's not likely, based on the history of past presidential debates, that this will affect who wins in November, but it is an important opportunity for both candidates to lay their case out to the American people and to, you know, mix it up with each other about their ideas about the best way to organize our country.
You said it's not likely to affect who wins, but is this year different because the polls are so tight right now, because these two candidates are not very well liked, and Donald Trump is a candidate that is unique in terms of who's come before him? Is this maybe a debate that could really matter?
I don't know. The argument for the debate mattering is, as you say, you know, both candidates are historically disliked by the electorate, and there are some constituencies that we might think of as naturals for the candidates where they haven't quite, you know, closed the deal. Some Republicans are still wavering on Donald Trump. Some younger liberals are still wavering on Hillary Clinton, and perhaps these debates can help these candidates either advance their agenda with those folks or continue to turn off those folks. And so it's possible that that could have some kind of effect. But usually, even in tight races like 4 years ago and 8 years ago and 12 years ago and 16 years ago, these debates might influence the polls a little bit in the short term, but tend not to be highly correlated with the result in the long term.
And in terms of what the candidates want to get done when they're up there tonight, they both have their own to-do lists. And just listening to the NPR story that was on a few minutes ago, the idea there is that Donald Trump should appear presidential and measured and in control and ready to take over the White House on day one and be a president. And Hillary Clinton, the idea there, the expert was saying, was to be warm and to be more approachable and all of those sort of more human qualities. So who's got the tougher job tonight?
Well, I think that it's a common reflex in news coverage to take the narrative about the candidates and then try to put that narrative on top of the presidential debate and say, well, Hillary Clinton must have problems connecting with people. Well, maybe, but she's winning most of the polls across the country. And they might say Donald Trump must appear presidential, but the Republican primary electorate thought he was presidential enough to select him as their nominee. And so I'm not so sure that those narratives are really what the candidates have before them tonight in terms of what it is they need to do. They need to appeal to people who haven't yet decided what they're going to do in the election, and they need to motivate people who support them to make sure that they show up and vote. Those are two different things, and I'm not so sure they have a lot to do with warmth or appearing presidential.
So appealing to undecideds, you're saying job one for both of these people and getting them out to the polls. So how is that accomplished?
Well, I think, you know, typically we think about candidates trying to do that in a few different ways, focusing on issues that undecided voters might care about. A lot of undecided voters are people who have views that fit with one party on some issues and the other party on other issues. And so candidates have to find a way to appeal to those voters without turning off voters who are their core base, who are way more likely to turn out to vote in the first place. And so they need to find ways to show how issues that are very, very popular or issues that their party is viewed favorably on are things that that candidate will do a good job on once president. And so they want to highlight their ability to do the work. They want to highlight their record of accomplishment. They want to give these voters an opportunity to conclude that person can do it. And if they make that conclusion, they might be more likely to give their support to that candidate and show up for them on election day.
We're getting a preview of tonight's debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton with Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. And let's talk about the moderator. This is a high-intensity job that Lester Holt has for tonight. What do you think is expected from him?
Everything. Right? You know, depending upon people's point of view, some people want Lester Holt to be a person who asks questions and keeps time and does nothing else. And others want Lester Holt to play a more active role in adjudicating factual disputes or calling out outright falsehoods. And so that's a high wire for a moderator to walk. Candy Crowley did this in one of the kind of public forum debates in the 2012 election, where citizens were there and asking questions, and they were debating Mitt Romney and President Obama about whether he had called Benghazi a terror attack or not. And Candy Crowley, you know, corrected Mitt Romney and said, well, he did say terrorism in the news conference, which he did. But it's also the case that some of the other things Romney had said in the answer were true about the length of time the White House took to walk back the idea that the attack was based on this videotape and other things like that. And so it's a high wire act for moderators because they're going to get criticized either way. I think the best thing to do would be is to be as prepared as possible by watching what the candidates have said and knowing what things they're saying out there that aren't true and being ready to say, we have evidence that that statement you just made isn't true, and here's that evidence.
So you shooting think that hip, Lester Holt should fact check?
I think he should if he has the evidence in front of him. Shooting from the hip, going from your memory, I think is too big of a risk in this kind of environment. But when you have tens of millions of people watching something and somebody running for president says something and the moderator knows it's not true, they have an obligation to tell those viewers that it's not true.
I think it was the debate commission. I saw a tweet saying they weren't sure it was the role of the moderator to be Encyclopedia Britannica. So maybe he's getting a different set of advice than what you just said.
I'm sure he is. And another moderator for a later debate, Chris Wallace of Fox News, has said it's not his job to call balls and strikes. It's his job to ask questions. And so that's how Wallace views that job. You know, Candy Crowley wasn't asked to be a moderator this time around. Maybe, you know, that. I mean, she's not working as a journalist in the way she was 4 years ago when she was a moderator for a debate. But you could certainly read into that, perhaps, if you wanted to. But, you know, I think if the evidence is incontrovertible and verifiable and you've got it in front of you as a moderator, it's better for the audience to know what's true and what isn't.
And recently, this has been another story attached to the debates coming up. Republican candidate again, Donald Trump, said that Lester Holt was a Democrat. Apparently, Holt is a registered Republican.
That's right.
And that story has been unfolding in tandem as the debate hype gets going. Is that going to play any part in what we hear tonight?
I think it makes it harder for the Trump campaign to say that Lester Holt was biased against them. One of Trump's spokeswomen said this morning that Trump wasn't lying because he just didn't know what party Lester Holt was in. And so I think a response to that might be, then why would you claim to be sure that he was a Democrat if you didn't know what party he was in, especially when it turns out that he's not one? But I think it makes it harder for the Trump campaign to say that they weren't treated fairly when they misidentified the party of the moderator, and the moderator actually is a member of the same party as Mr. Trump.
I'm seeing various takes on how we know whether someone is pulling out ahead or not. And one number I hear is that the first 10 minutes are important, that there might be a winner or at least an inclination towards someone inching ahead in those first 10 minutes. Do you agree? Is that kind of clutch time?
I don't know that the first 10 minutes matters for the viewers. I think it matters for the narrative in the post-debate analysis. And there's a lot of research that suggests what people say after the debate on television affects how people decide who won. And so hearing, just like in the post-game analysis of a football game, here's what the Packers did well or need to work on, comments about what candidates did and what worked can affect who won. And usually if you're getting ready to pull up live sound bites and do all that kind of analysis, you're going to pull from the early part of the debate because you need time to get it ready for the post-game analysis. And so I think it's important in that respect, but I don't think it's important for the viewers. Those who second screen and watch the debate on Twitter will also be affected by what their friends and people they follow on Facebook or Twitter say about who's performing well and who's making mistakes.
And just briefly, Mike, you're watching this tonight with a bunch of students. Are you going to also be following it on Twitter? What are you expecting for yourself and for these students watching?
Right. I'll be at Union South at the Elections Research Center watching the debate. Anybody can come. And I'll be watching Twitter to see how people are pouncing on particular comments in terms of fact-checking, in terms of groups that might be upset by things that get said, and in terms of whether people who are in undecided groups, or groups of people who are more undecided than not, are leaning one way or the other.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. And he was with us today to preview the first presidential debate, which begins tonight at 8 p.m. Central. And you can listen live on Wisconsin Public Radio. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Executive Producer Erica Janik.
Rosemary Drab created a pillow sham to honor her brother's service in the Civilian Conservation Corps. As part of our ongoing look at Wisconsin through objects, Joe Hermelin shares the stories woven into this 1930s textile from Langlade County.
I knew about the CCC's Civilian Conservation Corps in general, and when I moved to Antigo about 12 or 13 years ago, I started getting interested in the history of the area. And then when Ed Drab came into the museum about 8 or 9 years ago to talk about his experience in the CCC, and the pillow sham, a very tangible item related to the CCCs, it piqued my interest. Ed Drab, first of all, he was the son of Hungarian immigrants who had first come to Chicago, and then they moved up to northern Wisconsin and got a farm. During the Depression, they were in hard times, and he went off to the CCC camp. The farm was a little bit south and east of Antigo, and the camp was north of Antigo, so he wasn't that far from home. It was made by a woman, Rose Mary Drab, to honor her brother, Ed, who was heading off to the CCCs. It's appliqué. She appliqued a black cotton sateen sham. It's about the size that would cover a pillow. There's a small cotton tent on it, an eagle. There are two small stars, some scenes of hills and pine trees, and there's a large sunburst, all in green felted wool. The text, the embroidery says, CCC, U.S., Pres FDR, 1933, and Camp 657, which was the name of the camp he was stationed at, and that slogan, "When we finish our part, a new day will dawn," all in red thread. And I thought, here is an impoverished farm family in the Depression, and the optimism that's expressed in that pillow sham, the embroidery text, and that's the main reason why I was attracted to it. Rosemary Drab, she did do other embroideries and tapestry. She made a commemorative tapestry commemorating the CCCs, and it hung in the White House. She donated it to FDR. It was later transferred to the Roosevelt Museum in Hyde Park. She was quite active in embroidery. She started all this at about, I think she was about 10 years old when the mother of the family died, and she was 10 and became the house caregiver and taking care of things for the family. Well, different camps had different roles. The style of the camps were such that you signed up for a 6-month term, but it was renewable for up to 2 years. And he was fairly fresh out of high school, no job prospects. He was paid $30 a month, 25 of which was sent home. So he had $5 a month for himself. And he credits that $25 a month and $25 a month that his younger brother eventually sent back home when he enrolled to saving the family farm. They needed that money during the Depression.
That story was part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative project to explore Wisconsin's story through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
A Another object attached to the Wisconsin 101 project is an old 78 RPM record from Paramount Records. From 1917 to 1935, some of the most influential blues records were produced in Grafton, Wisconsin, in a building that housed an old chair factory.
To learn more about the significance of this historic Wisconsin landmark, we spoke with Amanda Petrasich, a music journalist and the author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Amanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, in shorthand, how did this old chair factory in Grafton became a music label?
Sure. It's a really incredible, sort of strange American story, very serendipitous in a way. But Paramount Records began as a subsidiary of the Wisconsin Chair Company, which was a furniture company that began making phonograph cabinets under contract for Thomas Edison. And at a certain point, they decided it would make kind of smart business sense to make records to go along with the pieces of furniture that they were producing to host, to hold turntables. And so, you know, the records were really an afterthought. It was never kind of the main idea or the main objective of the WCC to record blues musicians, but they started this label called Paramount, which cast a very wide net beginning in the 1920s when they launched a race record series. And via talent scouts and a few sort of fortunate accidents, ended up accidentally recording some of what I believe to be the greatest blues performances in history.
And give us a taste of some of the artists and the influence that this Paramount label had.
Sure. I mean, the influence is really extraordinary. I mean, they recorded folks like Charlie Patton and Blind Lemon Jefferson, and then also people like Skip James. And one of my favorite Paramount records is by a singer named Gishi Wiley, who recorded just a handful of sides for Paramount in the late 1920s, and about which we know very little other than her surviving records, which are extraordinarily rare and collectible. But she came up from Natchez, Mississippi via a talent scout and recorded six songs for the label, my favorite of which is a song called Last Kind Word Blues. But those songs, I mean, became influential documents of the kind of blues canon and, you know, later inspired folks, you know, like Keith Richards or Eric Clapton or the sort of second wave of rock and roll bands were hugely influenced by those records that were recorded here in Wisconsin.
What did Paramount do that made these recordings so great? Was it the artists that they found, or was it something about the way they approached it?
It's sort of the million-dollar question with Paramount. It's, you know, in many ways, it just feels like this thing that sort of happened by accident. I mean, the records themselves actually sound pretty terrible. They 78s are made of a shellac compound that has a lot of clay and dirt and other things in it. And they weren't using a great mix. Collectors and certainly sound archivists are kind of constantly griping about the relative shoddiness of Paramount pressings. And then even the recording studio that they built in Grafton to host performers who came up mostly from the South was also not state-of-the-art. But they did have some really good talent scouts that were working for the company. But really, by and large, what happened there is sort of, it feels almost like a mystical occurrence. It's, you kind of can't make heads or tails of it, of how this sort of funny little label ended up, you know, being inadvertently responsible for these really tremendous recordings.
Talking to Amanda Petrasich about a Wisconsin furniture company that became a preeminent blues label for a while here in the state and around the nation. Now, shoddy or not, these things became collector's items, so much so that at least one person has gone scuba diving in the Wisconsin River to find them. That was you. Tell us how that came to be.
Sure. Well, so when the company went under during the Great Depression, for years these sort of rumors persisted that the employees were so disgruntled and so disappointed and kind of devastated that they'd lost their jobs. They were angry, so they just hurled all the dead stock. So the remaining Paramount records that had been pressed but had not yet been sent to distributors just frisbeed them into the Milwaukee River. And so for years, collectors have been saying that that is in part why Paramount records are now so rare and so coveted and so expensive and so impossible to find, is because they all got kind of tossed into a watery mass grave. And so when I heard that story, I was just beginning the kind of work, the research and reporting of my book, and I was catching the bug a little bit too. I mean, I'm a big music fan and I'd collected LPs for many years, but 78s were sort of new to me. And I was spending all this time with these collectors who had these incredible collections, and I felt a little bit like, oh God, I'm coming to this too late. I want these records. I can't find them anywhere. I can't afford them. And when I heard that story, I thought, like, well, okay, maybe I'm just sort of young and dumb enough to try this. and maybe it would be a way to, you know, both get closer to the label and the place where these records that mean so much to me were made. And also I was hoping I could just find some sort of evidence of what had happened there.
And what did you find down there?
Well, I have to say the Milwaukee River is not a great place to scuba dive. It's very muddy. It's very shallow in that particular stretch of Grafton. I sort of flailed around in the water for a day. I found some pieces that were later were fairly sure were part of the old pressing plant, but I was not able, unfortunately, to come up with any records, which I think maybe from the start I knew it was sort of a fool's errand, but it felt like a kind of initiation in a way, like a thing I had to do.
Well, diving or not, what got you into collecting these old 78 RPM records like the ones from Paramount Records in Wisconsin?
Well, I was a fan of a lot of the music, pre-war American vernacular music, country blues, hillbilly country, gospel music. I was, you know, loved that stuff, and I had listened to it primarily on digital reissues or LP reissues. And it wasn't until I was reporting a story for Spin Magazine about the commercial resurgence of vinyl records. A bunch of artists were reissuing their whole back catalogs on vinyl. And I was talking to a source who told me, vinyl collectors are obsessive. Record collectors of LPs are really interesting. But if you want to talk to someone who's completely insane, find a 78 collector. So I did that. I met a collector in New York who I later profiled for the New York Times and was able to hear a 78 played in front of me for the first time and found it to be transformative.
Well, vinyl sales are on the up. Upswing Record Store Day keeps getting more popular. What is it about vinyl, collecting records, that you think is so attractive to people? Why is it booming right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think in part, you know, the tactile experience of having something in your hands, you know, the ritual of playing it. I think in our sort of increasingly fragmented and accelerated and virtual world, there's something really satisfying and sort of anchoring about that. I also think they sound really, really great. If you're used to listening to MP3s through, you know, kind of crappy earbuds, listening to a record played on a proper stereo can be really revelatory. And I think people just like to, you know, to have a collection that they can say, you know, this says a little something about who I am.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Amanda Petrosich, a music journalist and the author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. We were talking about Paramount Records, a former record-pressing plant in Grafton, Wisconsin, that was responsible for producing some of the most influential blues records of the time. Politics and comedy frequently go hand in hand. Politics helped propel comedians like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert into the limelight. And shows like The Daily Show with Stewart at the helm became a go-to source of news and political commentary for many young people.
And comedy has once again taken center stage in this presidential election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Both have been the target of jokes over the campaign, but for different reasons.
Joining us now to talk about the role comedy plays in politics is Amy Bree Becker. She's an assistant professor of communications at Loyola University in Maryland and an expert in political satire and comedy. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we've been through presidential elections covered by late night comedians before. Is this year any different, do you think?
It's a little bit different in that one of the candidates is a reality TV star, so someone who's a little bit more practiced at trying to appear entertaining and engaging on television.
And how does that change things for the comedians who are covering the
Well, I think, you know, he's also got some unpopular political positions. So part of what's going on in political comedy this time, if you watch, you know, John Oliver's clip last night, is really picking apart and criticizing the candidates. And you're seeing certainly more criticism by satirists of Donald Trump than you are of Hillary Clinton. It's a different story when you talk about late-night comedy. I know there's a lot that's been written about how Jimmy Fallon wasn't, you know, tough on Donald Trump. But it's the difference when you're talking about satire versus late-night comedy.
Well, let's talk about that Jimmy Fallon moment you mentioned, because that created headlines and other comedians got in on that and commented. So there was this moment last week when NBC's Tonight Show host Jimmy Fallon was with GOP nominee Donald Trump and got a lot of attention for what didn't happen. But here's what did happen.
Donald, I want to ask you, because the next time I see you, you could be the president of the United States. I just wanted to know if there's something we could do that's just not presidential, really, or something that we can do now that we're just both civilians. Like
what? This is I'm not liking the sound of this.
Go ahead. Can I mess your hair up?
So what happened after that is a criticism by Samantha Bee, another late-night comedian, saying that was too soft. This is a man who could possibly be president of the United States, and Fallon should not have given that sort of easy-breezy treatment of him and should have asked him real questions. So what do you think about that whole debate that unfolded?
Well, I think you need to think about Fallon's program and his nature as an interviewer. His program is really primarily entertainment. If Samantha Bee is political satire, and so that's where the tougher questions would come. I do think, though, it is a presidential race, and certainly Trump has been able to get more free media attention than Hillary Clinton, if you look at all the research. And so there is a certain responsibility when featuring either of the major candidates on your show, but it's important that we remember that Jimmy Fallon classifies himself as, you know, network late-night comedy. He's not a political satire program. He's not even Stephen Colbert.
Right, and that's what Fallon said. He said, this is how I treat all my guests, but Samantha Bee wasn't having it, and she wasn't the only one. There were other people who started popping up and saying, yes, he should have been. This maybe is a different scenario than we've seen before, and here's what Bee said on her show.
Aw, Trump can be a total sweetheart with someone who has no reason to be terrified of him. I noticed there were no cutaway shots to the roots. I wonder why. Network execs. Yeah.
There's Samantha Bee talking about her response there. And then it almost did seem after that that Jimmy Fallon maybe accepted a tiny portion of blame. And he did a spot with Hillary Clinton where she opened a bag of softballs and he said, oh, those were my gifts to Donald Trump. And he left them behind. So I don't know. Did he accept some culpability there?
I think so. But he also turned it into another comic moment for him. You know, it's not just when we study political ads, it's not just the effect of watching the ad when it airs, but it's, you know, the media breakdown and the fact checking and all the reporting on the ad that comes after it. It's the same thing with political comedy. So it's not just the interview with Donald Trump, but all of the criticism certainly created more media attention for Fallon over, you know, someone like Seth Meyers.
And we're talking right now with Amy Bree Becker. She is assistant professor of communications at Loyola University in Maryland and an expert in political satire and comedy. And how would you grade what we're seeing this season?
There's a lot of people who I talk to in my circle who still miss Jon Stewart, but I think there's a lot of great content out of there, out in the marketplace right now. I think John Oliver is really probably the most critical and satirical voice right now. His piece on scandals last night has been viewed on YouTube pretty considerably today, and I think he's really doing the investigative work, the work of investigative journalism, to kind of pick apart these candidate scandals. So I think that his work is very important. I think that we are seeing there's more content. Even though Jon Stewart is not here, we've got Samantha Bee, we've got Stephen Colbert bringing political candidates on. Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers is certainly weighing in, and John Oliver, and Trevor Noah, and you know, so on. So there's much more content than there ever was before. The other thing that's really important is viral video. And so Hillary Clinton's Funny or Die clip over the first one online on Thursday has, when I checked this morning, over 9.5 million views on YouTube. And those small pieces are also significant as well. And we didn't have that as much in prior election cycles.
You said you missed Jon Stewart from The Daily Show. What do you think he brought to it that maybe no one else is quite hitting that high water mark this time around?
I think he had the ability to really criticize everyone. And certainly, you know, he would probably be criticizing Donald Trump more than Hillary Clinton, but he was pretty cognizant of making sure to make fun of politics on both sides of the aisle. And I think that he was had a very honest and refreshing satirical take that really resonated with, you know, young people, old people, sort of a whole range of viewers. And I think that maybe his particular bite, let's say, is missing a little bit from this election.
Seth Meyers is one who has been giving us a little bite, especially when it comes to Donald Trump. And he weighed in on the birther controversy. Here's what Seth Meyers said.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008
started the birther controversy. I finished it. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period.
Obama was born in the United States, period. You, exclamation point. You don't get to peddle racist rhetoric for 5 years and decide when it's over. We decide when it's over. And it's certainly not over after a 30-second statement in the middle of a hotel commercial.
Listening to that, I mean, that's very sharp and pointed, and it feels like Myers really means it in that moment. Is there more of that sort of bite in this year's election with some of these late-night comedians than we've seen in other elections?
I think so, and I also think that there's, in part, that's a response to what we're seeing or not seeing in the regular mainstream media. So, you know, there's a lot of coverage of the debate tonight, right? And it seems like the standards that Hillary needs to meet are very different than, you know, Donald Trump basically needs to show up and kind of behave, right, to do well tonight, according to the media. That's very different from what we're expecting from Hillary. And I don't know, you know, part of it is a gender bias, certainly, but there's been this kind of lack of criticism, I think, coming from traditional media outlets, and so comedy is having to pick up the slack.
Amy Bree Becker is with us right now talking about the role of comedy in political commentary. She's assistant professor of communications at Loyola University in Maryland and an expert in political satire and comedy.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think comedians, late night talk show hosts play in politics? Do you watch them? Do you watch them live? Do you watch the online clips the day after? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about the role comedy and comedians play in the political process and in the conversation around politics.
And we'd like to hear from you. What role do you think comedians have to play in the political process? Or do you think they should stay out of the fray? Are they changing your mind at all, do you think, or moving the needle? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also let us know if there's a particular bit of comedy that you thought was especially effective that made you laugh this season. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about comedy and late night talk shows with Amy Bree Becker. She's an assistant professor of communications at Loyola University in Maryland and an expert in political satire and comedy.
And Amy, one question is, how effective is all of this? I mean, I guess we've all seen the links, people share them, people are laughing. Is there any indication that this is changing the way people think or are informed about politics?
Sure. Well, you know, it depends on who you're talking about and who's viewing these clips. But it certainly does. It's particularly important for millennials who prefer entertaining news over traditional news formats. It's hard to ultimately measure the effect of some of these clips, but it is, you know, it's not people who happen to have an HBO account and are sitting down and watching HBO, you know, on a Sunday night when John Oliver is on. It's those who are watching the free clips on YouTube and sharing them. And so there is kind of this viral effect of comedy, and people really want, for better or worse, to be able to vote for politicians who have a sense of humor, who, you know, they wouldn't mind sitting down and having a beer with. And whether that's good or bad for our politics, you know, is a much larger debate. But certainly political comedy brings news to those who might otherwise not tune in and not pay attention to politics. So they're actually, you know, research has shown that they're learning something about politics by watching this non-traditional media content.
And it seems like Hillary Clinton, at least recently, has tried to appeal to that younger audience. And she part of the MO that she's taken up is appearing on some things maybe that are a little more risky, like the Funny or Die series. It's Between Two Ferns, and it's hosted by comedian Zach Galifianakis. It's kind of this awkward brand of comedy that could be pretty uncomfortable. Here's what happened.
As secretary, how many words per minute could you type? And how does President Obama like his coffee? Like himself? Week.
You know, Zach, those are really out-of-date questions. You need to get out more.
What happens if you become pregnant? Are we going to be stuck with Tim Kaine for 9 months? How does this work?
I could send you some pamphlets that might help you understand.
First, you supported Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and then you were against it. I think that people deserve to know Are you down with TPP?
I'm not down with TPP.
No, you're supposed to say, yeah, you know me. Like the hip-hop group.
Don't tell me what to say.
Fine, lose.
Okay, so there's a bit of Hillary Clinton in between two ferns with host Zach Galifianakis. This was largely considered a win by the media. What did you think about it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, what's important about it, again, 9.5 million views already on YouTube, on the Funny or Die channel. It doesn't count, you know, the shorter versions that have been, you know, posted on other, you know, articles about the video, things like that. Hillary Clinton does need to appeal to millennials, and this is one way to do it. And, you know, you can argue about the effectiveness of her, you know, deadpan style and her willingness to engage or not engage with Zach Galifianakis, but it is certainly a clip that has gotten much more attention than, you know, an interview on a late night comedy program that she could have done, or certainly will be viewed by more of the people that she needs to reach than a traditional news interview.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Dan on the line with us in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. I was just wanted to comment on the fact that late night comedy shows being on major stations, NBC, ABC, seem to reach a much larger audience than can be found through these big, you know, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC type channels, and they also bring comedy seems to just bring a lot better or a lot more palatability to these kind of political issues than are otherwise reached.
Dan, thanks for that. And Dan, sort of getting at what you were saying about how this sort of gives a spoonful of sugar with the news to help it go down a little easier. It makes you laugh. Maybe you learn something. So I imagine that's part of it, like you were talking about. But what about his claim that he thinks it reaches more audiences?
Well, it's not just when it airs on network television. It's really what gets shared. And it's when students, you know, I'm a professor, when students are on Facebook and they're looking to see pictures of their friends and they bump into a video that somebody shared that is a political comedy moment, they're getting that, you know, small bit of political information that they wouldn't otherwise get. And so we tend to bump into political comedy when we're online more than traditional news content. And so that's a big piece of it. So it's not, you know, whether they're on a network television or cable. John Oliver certainly has a significant reach, and he's on HBO, right, which is technically, you know, premium paid television content. He does post the main segment of his show for free on YouTube, but he really is, you know, behind a paywall in a sense for the larger program, but has a really significant impact. So I don't think that the networks matter as much as the amount and the frequency with which these clips are shared.
Let's take one more quick call. We've got Mark in Delavan. Mark, hi.
Mark, hi, ladies. How are you both?
Good, thanks. What did you want to share?
I'm hoping your guest can remember a little bit of what I'm going to be talking about. I realized you were just talking about John Oliver. I didn't hear all of what was said. I hope you didn't go over what I want to say. And that is the effect that John Oliver has. He's done a number of things. Not too long ago, he did a show, the part of the show that your guest, I believe, was just talking about, in which he talked about how cheaply a company can buy people's debt, like pennies on the dollar.
All right, this is all we have time for, Mark, but I think we've got the gist. You're a big John Oliver fan. I don't know if you know the part he's talking about, Amy, but why do you think he's so effective?
I think that his... I think he's effective because he's funny, number one, and he intersperses his kind of off-brand, kind of quirky British humor with a fair amount of information. And so he is really giving you really a healthy dosage of news. If you look at his writer's room, you know, it's staffed with comedians, but also former reporters from ProPublica, from New York Times. And so it's a little bit more information-rich, kind of like investigative journalism. And so I think that's part of why he spreads so quickly. He also, in a lot of his clips, and I've done some research on this with colleagues, he gives a call to action. So during the net neutrality debate, he told people to go online to the FCC website and leave a comment.
And we have to leave it there. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Amy Bree Becker, Assistant Professor of Communications at Loyola University in Maryland, and she's an expert in political satire and comedy.